Talking about the life of Frank Sinatra with Mark Shaw, noted author. One of his books includes Collateral Damage. The other, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much. He's one of the greatest journalists out there today. We're going to be back with him. More of your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Mark Shaw with us. Mark, what did you think would be the most fascinating aspect of the life of Frank Sinatra?
Well, I think you hit it. He was like two people. You know, it bothered me when you said that he cut off Sammy Davis Jr., because what you said before was that, you know, he stood up for Sammy Davis Jr. at a hotel and said, you know, he wouldn't stay there if Davis couldn't. I mean,
right.
He was like that. I thought that was interesting because and sad because I found a quote, and I believe I attribute this in my notes to one of your listeners. He said, you know, Mark, if you want to know about how Frank Sinatra cut off people or what he said about them, apparently there was a violent argument between Peter Lawford and Sinatra when Peter Lawford had dined with the woman that you talked about, Frank's future wife, Ava Gardner. And of that escapade, Lawford said, I was panicked. I mean, I was really scared. Frank's a violent guy, and he's good friends with too many guys who'd rather kill you than say hello.
Jeez.
And so you hear that, and you think, wait a minute, that can't be Frank Sinatra. But it is. And so I think, you know, there are two sides to him, and I think that will be the thing that I think about more than anything, because and the whole relationship with the Kennedys was just a strange one for sure. They used him. You know, we were talking a minute ago, if you think about how strange this is, we were talking about the way that the mafia, Frank Sinatra, and the Kennedys treated people, cutting them off, at a moment's notice if they somehow or another offended, anybody in the Kennedy
right.
family or Sinatra or, of course, anybody in the underworld. That was it. They had their own rules with regard to things. And so that whole relationship with Sinatra and the Kennedys, I think that's the thing that stands out to me, figuring out how that must have, as I say, I'm looking into the psychology of the Kennedys, a little bit into the workings of the Warren Commission as well, which has always fascinated me. But one of the areas now that you've tuned me into is looking into more of the psychology of Frank Sinatra and how he looked at the world. Wasn't that interesting, George, what he told Larry King?
Yeah, well, fascinating.
I don't know if I believed him or not, that he wasn't asked to be interviewed, but that was really an insight into his personality, didn't you think?
Yep, absolutely. I've been wondering what it would be like had he been around and we interviewed him. Would he walk out of the studio if he was upset?
Oh, I think he would have. I think if you would have, if you'd have touched a nerve, I mean, that's all it took. He had that trigger temper of his, It didn't take much. You talked about Howard Hughes cutting him off. Well, the rest of that story that was told to me, I don't know if you remember, but I was looking into the main suspect in Dorothy Kilgallen's death, Ron Pataki, the journalist.
Right.
And I found the pit boss at the Sands Hotel. And he told me that story as well about Frank Sinatra, that they cut him off and everything. And the rest of that story was he was so upset, he slugged the other casino pit boss and then ripped the tablecloth off of one of the gambling tables. I mean, that's the side of him that was there. And it's amazing that somebody just didn't beat the you-know-what out of him at some point or put a gun to his head. I don't see how he survived. He certainly was a survivor, wasn't he?
In Las Vegas, I met the aide of Frank Sinatra when he when the aide was in his 20s. Not Frank, but the aide. And he said Frank had such a temper when he didn't get to have his own way, you wouldn't believe it. He said it was absolutely scary.
And you have to think about where that anger comes from. I tell people most of the time, I get some really nasty emails and all this kind of thing and angry and say terrible things about me and all. That's just part of it, or on Facebook and everything. But I always think it's more about them than it is about me. I wonder if it was more about Frank and somehow or another, it's tough to be a star. It's tough to be a celebrity. Marilyn found that out. Dorothy found that out. Others have too. And so I wonder if there was some... did he have an inferiority complex at times? and you know, whatever. And that, you know, would have triggered that temper, because there really isn't any other reason I can think of. He was on top of the world most of the time, and yet he had that anger, and it caused him all kinds of problems to just burst out at a certain thing that would just upset him so much. I mean, they were giving him, according to that pit boss, they were giving him $50,000 worth of free chips all the time.
And he'd lose all the time.
Through them, and then he expected to get more.
He must have been one of the world's worst gamblers.
I think so. I think you're right. He could sing, but he couldn't gamble.
That's right. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Eric, truck driving in Indiana, to get us started. Hello, Eric.
Hello, George. Hi, Mark.
Hello there. I'm an Indiana guy myself, born in Auburn, up by Fort Wayne.
Oh, yeah. I go up there every morning up there to Fort Wayne. I know where Auburn is. Yes, sir. Up there by Portland and all that, but... got a couple of questions for you, and seemed like it, Jimmy Hoffa had a bad temper too, almost like Frank. And just wondering if him and Jimmy Hoffa might have hooked up, you know, knew each other, or bumped into each other, or whatever. And how about Jimmy Dean? What kind of relationship did he have with him?
Well, George probably can answer this better than I can, because I know he interviewed Jimmy Hoffa late in his life. I've never been able to find a connection between James Hoffa and Frank Sinatra, but you would have known that Hoffa would have been aware of him. And because then, of course, Hoffa was connected to Carlos Marcello, who I pinpointed as orchestrating JFK's death, Sano Trafficante, all those guys, and Giancana, and so was Frank. You know, he's always right in the middle of things. So I'll look into that. I appreciate it. I'll look into that. As far as Jimmy Dean, I don't know anything about him. Maybe George does.
I don't, but I'll tell you about the Hoffa connection with Sinatra.
Sure.
Frank knew Hoffa's right-hand man, Harold Gibbons.
Oh.
Who was part of the Teamsters, and they were very, very close. I'm not sure Frank knew Hoffa that well, but if he knew Harold Gibbons, he must have been able to get the Hoffa once in a while.
Fascinating. Yeah. Fascinating. Thank you.
But I don't know about Dean either.
Yeah.
Tom in La Jolla, California. You're going to like this call. Go ahead, Tom.
George, thank you for accepting my call. And Mark Shaw, always a pleasure. You bring to the table the very best research.
Oh,
thank you for your research. And I have a comment. I want to set this up in the comment and then ask the question. On YouTube, there's a couple of videos. One video is an interview with Frank Sinatra, and the other interview is with his daughter, Tina Sinatra. In the interview with Frank talked about that one of the most important things that he ever did in his life was act in the movie The Manchurian Candidate.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
And he bought the property of The Manchurian Candidate and owned the movie. And then Tina Sinatra gives this video interview, and she said several years before Frank died, Frank sat her down and said, look, I'm going to die eventually. But he goes, when I die, he goes, I'm giving you an assignment. He goes, I own the movie, The Manchurian Candidate. I want to see a remake. Of course, you know, he died before he saw the remake. And he goes, I want you to take charge and make sure that The Manchurian Candidate, the movie, gets remade. And he goes, I want you, not just any remake, he goes, I want the very best mm-hmm. production team, director, script writer, actors and actresses, etc. And so Tina Sinatra was like, wow, you know. And so they discussed it in years before Frank passed away, and then Tina kept working on it, and finally her group, you know,
mm-hmm.
brought together, and they released the movie, The Manchurian Candidate, which I think was 2002. And again, she fulfilled her father's wishes, got the best director, Denzel Washington and Meryl Streep to act in it, and best script writer, that type of thing. So this brings me to my question. It seems just my opinion. This is just my opinion. It seems to me that Frank wanted his legacy, so to speak, to bring to the screen again, you know, a polished version of a movie, which, what's the subject matter? Okay, trauma-based mind control and the facilitation of assassination. Okay, so I'm wondering if perhaps you can connect the dots for that for the audience. You know, it seems to me that Frank had a message there.
Yeah, I think he may have. You know, first of all, we haven't talked too much about the fact that, you know, he was a sensational actor. And I don't think he ever had any training with that. I don't know where it all came from, but you can't watch those films of him. He was just amazing in that way. That movie gives me the chills when I watch it, because there's a lot of people, you know, who believe that, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald may have been, controlled to have killed JFK. Jack Ruby may have been. There's these other conjectures about things that have happened like that with assassinations and all of that. But I find it very interesting. I'm glad you brought it up. I must show my ignorance. I did not know that there was a remake of The Manchurian Candidate. I had no idea. Maybe George has, but
yeah, there
you know, maybe that's what he was interested in, that sort of situation, or maybe, you know, when I don't know when that would have been, but I assume it's after the JFK assassination, and perhaps, you know, nobody's ever found out what Frank Sinatra thought of the JFK assassination. I've never seen anything written or whatever. I'm just thinking, and it's speculation, of course, that maybe there was some thought of his that whoever killed JFK may have been mind-controlled or whatever. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but that's the first thought that I have.
Well, and if you and I continue to believe who killed JFK, the Marcellos and Traficantes, I wonder if Sinatra knew that.
Well, as close as he was to Giancana, who, you know, you have to remember, you know, Hoffa, Hoffa, Marcello, and Traficante had the same lawyer, Frank Rogano. And as I say, I'm doing some research for this next book, and I did find...
And they knew each other.
Yeah, that's right. A 1968-69 FBI file for Marcello. And I was amazed when I went through it, and also when I went through the JFK documents that had come out. The names in there are amazing. F. Lee Bailey is in the Marcello file. Jim Garrison is in there. Melvin Belli is in there. Frank Rogano is in there. Traficante is in there. And so, to answer your question, the connections between those individuals and all of them connected. You know, one of Frank Sinatra's idols was Mickey Cohen.
The little gangster, right?
That's right. Melvin Belli's main client and all of that. And to the effect that when Cohen, you know, went to prison finally for, I think, killing somebody or hurt, you know, beating up somebody with a lead pipe or something, and Belli was his lawyer. When he got out, the first person who helped him out was Frank Sinatra. He gave him $20,000, which in that day and age would have been an awful lot of money. And then I found a FBI memo that talks about that in Frank Sinatra's notebook was all the information about where Mickey Cohen lived and all that he was doing, everything. So, you know, those connections are all in there. Frank was connected for sure, and that's an area that I'm probably going to look into a little bit more now with what this gentleman has said.
Now, Sinatra's Manchurian Candidate came out in 1962.
Oh.
The remake came out in 2004 with Denzel Washington.
Oh, interesting. So one was before the assassination, and then I've never seen the one in 2004. I didn't know there was one.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Next up, Joe, Long Island, New York. Welcome to the program. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Yeah, Mark, I have two comments before I get to my mob question. First of all, Frank does seem like he was, like, right out of the movie La Dolce Vita, you know, at the beach scene at the end, just hanging out and partying all the time. And his drinking probably was a big factor in his being erratic and temperamental. But one person to look into is Mia Farrow, because she only was married otherwise to another guy for 8 years in the 70s. Otherwise, she hasn't been married. And, you know, you could maybe interview her and ask her what her take was on Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, she was married to Frank for 2 years, 66 to 68.
Yeah. The other point is, like, if you look at Carly Simon, I mean, she never overcame stage fright. Now, Frank must not have had stage fright, but I can understand his being irritated with the press because he's doing all these charity things and, you know, it's a lot of time and you have to really choreograph it. And, you know, it's like armchair stuff. They're writing like a vicious article about him. And he's in the, doing the work. He's on the field. He's doing the movies. He's doing the concerts. You know, he's in front of the crowd. It's easy enough to write an article lambasting him. But my question is, he did seem to be settled in with the mafia for sure. He did hang out with these people. What would have been the quid pro quo between either way? You know, maybe they could have gotten him some parts. I know they were in with some of the Hollywood, like Roy Khan or whatever, or the producers, but I just don't see that that's clear. What was either party getting out of that relationship?
Well, I think, again, you know, everybody wants to be important, and he was on top of the world as an entertainer, but he liked to have that appearance of being involved with the mafia. And you know, you can't underestimate the situation where Joe Kennedy believes the Kennedys are going to lose that 60 election. And there's a lot of things they could have done to try to, you know, influence what was going to happen in Illinois and West Virginia and everything else. But who in the world, of all the people they could have gone to, did they contact? And that was Sinatra. And then that was because of his connections with Giancana and Marcello and those kinds of people. So I think, you know, in lots of ways, and I would, again, compare it to Melvin Belli, the lawyer for Jack Ruby. I knew Belli. I practiced law with him in the 80s in San Francisco. He had the ego the size of Texas, and so did Frank. And it was a big deal where, you know, Belli used to and I used to go to lunch with him where he would talk to people about, you know, yeah, I don't tell anybody, but I'm a member of the San Mateo, California Mafia, which was south of San Francisco. Well, he wasn't, but he liked that appearance of that. And so I think that Frank relished that appearance with the mafia. And of course, with them, you know, having a big-time star entertainer who was seen with him, who's in photographs with him, all of that, you know, that's a big deal for them, too, because in some ways it gives them a bit of legitimacy. Yeah, people wondered about Sinatra, but here's the big star of stage and screen and a singer and all of that. And, you know, here I am. I'm sitting at a table with Frank Sinatra, or I'm in a photograph with Frank Sinatra. So I think that's something that would have made a difference to them, trying to make people feel like, you know, we're not such bad people. Frank Sinatra is one of our friends.
Frank hated the movie The Godfather because in it, Al Martino playing Johnny Fontaine was basically playing the role of Sinatra. He did not like that at all.
He didn't want to cross Frank, according to his mother, remember? You got to be
right.
Careful with that.
He had his own record label, too, right? What was it called?
Oh, my. There's another instance. I'm glad you brought it up. Here's a wild one for you. Reprise Records with a guy named Shore in Los Angeles. Melvin Belli, supposedly one of the stories as to how he became Jack Ruby's lawyer, and he lied about it in all the different ways.
Hold on right there, Mark. I'll have you pick that up when we come right back when we take final calls as well. Next hour, Yvonne Smith joins us as we talk about alien abductions and her work as a hypnotherapist on Coast to Coast. And when we come back in just a moment, we'll take final calls with our special guest, Mark Shaw, as we talk about the life of Frank Sinatra. And welcome back, George Norrie with you, our final segment with Mark Shaw. Mark, you were talking about the gangster Mickey Cohen. His parents were born in the Ukraine. Can you believe that?
Well, that's on all of our minds, that's for sure. Bless those people. I hope this war can be stopped some way or another. You know, you mentioned Sinatra owning his records. It was called Reprise Records, and it was over in Santa Monica there somewhere. And Michael Shore was the man who ran it. And he had some mafia connections and was a good friend of Earl Ruby's. And the story came down that Earl Ruby is the one, or Shore is the one who introduced Melvin Belli to Earl Ruby, and that's how Melvin Belli became the lawyer for Jack Ruby. I've subsequently found that that may not have been true, that it was I think they called them mafia businessmen in Las Vegas who, ended up hiring Belli, but there was that connection. And then I just found this one little tidbit that I think you'll be interested in because it connects Marcello with Sinatra. And I think it came from a tip from a listener, and I hope your listeners, if they have any, will get in touch with me. My website's markshawbooks.com, and you can get in touch with me there. When Carlos Marcello attempted to make peace with the Kennedys, the House Select Committee on Assassinations report detailed efforts by Santo Trafficante to intercede on Marcello's behalf with singer Frank Sinatra, a friend of the Kennedys and Trafficante. A wiretap conversation between Philadelphia mobster Angelo Bruno, that's the one I mentioned at one time, and an underboss in Pennsylvania disclosed that Sinatra discussed Marcello with Robert Kennedy.
Jeez.
The effort backfired, and RFK intensified his efforts to nab the mafia chieftain.
And had him deported, didn't he?
Yeah, well, he wasn't able to, no, at that particular point.
But they picked him up and dumped him somewhere in South America.
Oh, yes, exactly. That's exactly, in Guatemala.
Yep.
They sent him to Guatemala, and that's one of the reasons when he got back, there's the motive for getting rid of, JFK so Bobby would be powerless and all of that. But you see, I mean, he's just amazing how he connects with all this. It's like a giant-sized puzzle with all of these people that we've all heard about, and Sinatra's right in the middle of it.
He knew everybody.
He certainly did.
Let's go back to the phones. Diana's with us in Antelope Valley, California. Welcome to the show. Hi, Di. Go ahead.
Hi. Good evening, gentlemen. I noticed a few times that the mother of Francis, Frank, was referred to, and she said, don't make him angry. But nothing's been said about his upbringing, teen years, the years before his career.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I wonder why that was said by her.
I don't know exactly. I do know that there's the conflicting stories about Frank Sinatra's upbringing. Some people said that he was born wealthy and then he was born poor and all of that. Somebody emailed me, I guess they saw that I was going to be on the program tonight, and they suggested a Frank Sinatra documentary on Netflix. And I decided just to take a quick look at it tonight. And the first part of that documentary, because I like to be prepared as George always is, and I watched just about half an hour of it, and it is about Frank Sinatra. He's basically telling his story about his upbringing with his mother and father, and it takes it up into just when he decided he wanted to be become a singer. What I found interesting is that the production company of that documentary is Kathleen Kennedy, who's a partner with the famous director of directed West Side Story, the movie that came out. Anybody help me? Anyway.
We'll get it. Our staff will get it.
I found out that was the production company, but it's an excellent documentary. And to answer your question, Di, I think you might be best to, instead of my
Spielberg
speculating or whatever, to take a look at that documentary.
Was it Spielberg?
Yes. Thank you.
There you go. And then, Di, you had another question. Go ahead.
If I may, please. Thank you.
Yeah.
I noticed during your conversations that there's third-party hearsay. I'm not saying Frank Francis is not an angel, was an angel. But he said, she said, this was reported, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I find that third-party hearsay very much, obviously, is not reliable. Now,
whoever Frank introduced
Marilyn to, my mom used to model with Marilyn as Norma Jean, by the way.
Oh, my God.
She was a Christian woman. She knew her in 44. Anyway, well, whoever Frank introduced Marilyn to, the adults are responsible for their behavior. I think Frank learned in his young years, which leads me to this point, he had to cover his back. He wasn't a dumb man. He couldn't sing the way he did if he was, quote unquote, not on top of things. Mm-hmm. I hear too many allegations of third party hearsay. I know you quoted some directly, okay, a few, which I will look into.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as all the other stuff out there and the Kennedys, look what happened to them, unfortunately, is another story altogether.
Give us, give us one example that you're talking about, though, when you say third party.
The bartender at the table with Peter Lawford, when you fight over a woman, you know something's going to happen. Ava Gardner, okay? Number one, he said he busted out his teeth. You weren't there. Mark wasn't there.
Well, clearly he had his teeth were knocked out. I don't have to be there to believe that.
No, I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm just saying, and if you listen to what you two have done tonight, and I'll listen to it again on Beyond Belief, or Insider, again, there's three or four or five or six things that you have commented on that no one was there, and a third party said this happened, is what I'm saying.
I know, but I'm asking you to tell us what was that so we can address it for you.
No, and I respect that, and you kind of caught me off guard. One was with Ava Gardner, Men Fight Over Women. There was...
Okay, that's right from Peter Lawford.
Okay, that is right from Peter Lawford. He was interviewed on Johnny Carson, and Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra were on there as well in 77. Mm-hmm. There's also another instance. Oh, this is not totally related. When he is with Marilyn Monroe, Norma Jean, on the beach, it doesn't mean they were having an affair. They could have just been friends. This goes to people assuming things. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, but I don't think Mark said that Frank had an affair with Marilyn Monroe. She may have dated him, but I don't
see... He bought her a dog. Anyway, look, what I usually do with this, I'll tell you what, I very much respect your opinion. But I say we'll kind of have to agree to disagree, because I'm very careful, and I know George is, to watch what we do. We don't want to speculate, and so... you can email me. My email address is on my website. If you want to come up with some examples, send them to me, and I promise. I answer every email I get. So if you want to do that, Di, I promise I'll get back to you.
Thanks, Diane. Next up, we've got Laura in New York. Welcome to the show. Hello, Laura.
Hi. Good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We're running out of time, so I'll just tell you this story really fast. I worked at Radio City Music Hall, and Luciano Pavarotti and Frank Sinatra were there together one evening performing. And when the performance was over, you know, everyone left, and even though most of the staff left or the audience left, and the two of them were just standing there on the stage. They did at first have some staff around them, some security people, but the security people just walked away, I guess, to go get a soda or something, and Frank was just standing there all by himself. And so I went over to him, and I had the playbill from the evening, you know, which is the little theater booklet they give you.
Uh-huh.
And I went over, and he signed it, and then Pavarotti was also standing there with no one around him, and I went over there, and he signed it, and I said,
cool.
Thank you. They were both very nice. They signed it. I said thank you and walked away, and that was it. I just wanted to tell you that story.
Oh, that's a great little story.
Well, I'm glad you did, because that's the side of him that...
That's the fan-friendly side.
It is, and he had that side to him. I still think there was some insecurity there because of these anger outbursts. There was something going on there with his mental health, perhaps, or whatever. But, you know, it's tough to be a celebrity. George knows this. It's tough to be a celebrity. It's tough. You know, I was involved in the Hollywood... Hollywood land atmosphere at one particular point as an entertainment lawyer and doing some television and things like that. And what I noticed was it's very difficult for people down there. There's so much power involved and money involved and all of that. It's tough to get to the top. And then it's tough to stay at the top. And it's awful when you're not at the top anymore. And so I have a lot of sympathy for celebrities. And, you know, Sinatra wasn't... you know, he wasn't absent that kind of situation. I mean, we talked about a little while ago. At one point, he was apparently depressed enough that he was going to quit. Just think about that.
That's right. I remember on YouTube, they've got the Frank Sinatra retirement event.
Really?
That's cool. Jeff in Durango, Colorado, welcome to the show. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, glad to talk to y'all.
You too.
I'm a Vegas guy. My grandfather was a business partner of Joe Kennedy and the Sands Endeavor. And so my my aunt, my mom, and the young kids, I'm exactly your same age, George. And we were just around during the day a lot, you know, and my grandfather was there. And so we, you know, crossed paths with all those guys. I know that Sammy and Dean they were such warm guys that they were Frank Seeanker. But I know this, and if you don't know this, yeah, it's the Rosetta Stone of the whole thing, to Frank's life. Okay, Marty Sinatra, when Frank was born, he had severe head trauma, and they put him on the porch and left him for dead. And Marty Sinatra went out there and gathered up the little infant, and he came back to life. It was a
miracle.
It was a miracle, and Marty Sinatra is just a prince of a man. So what I'm going to say is not insulting Marty. De La Guerra Venta, Frank's mom, was a genius. She was one of, and a singer, dynamic singer. Frank, I'm sure, got some of that talent from all of it from her. And but Frank's cranial trauma, that causes that creates a thing called organic behavior disorder, and you have it for life. And the temper volcano is actually a seizure. And often afterwards, the person that does it is as traumatized and has a lapse of memory, can't even remember accurately, and is traumatized as much as everybody else is. And that's something that he had to live with. It's almost like Robin Williams' Tourette's. You know what I mean? It was a burden for him, because the basic guy, and you have to know, and this is the Rosetta Stone. Frank Sinatra is Joe Kennedy's natural son.
Oh, is that correct?
And he had all of Joe Kennedy's dynamics.
Natural son.
And
never heard that one before.
And his mom worked for Joe Kennedy. She was one of Joe Kennedy's ward bosses and very tight with him, obviously, you know. And Marty was Joe Kennedy's employee, you know. And De La Guerra Venta's brothers were fighters. They were boxers. So Frank had all that going for him, too. I mean,
all
you
right,
know.
Let's get your reaction to that, Mark. I've never heard that story before.
George, I don't know what to say. I haven't either. I will tell you that in this documentary I mentioned, the Spielberg and Kennedy documentary, the first part of it is about the fact that they had problems when Frank Sinatra was delivered as a baby. And there were some questions about whether he was going to live or not, and he says, Sinatra does, on the documentary, my mother was smart enough to take me over and put my head under cold water. And that's what brought me basically back to life.
Jeez.
So I can comment on that part. But as far as Sinatra being Joe Kennedy's son, if you don't mind, email me with any research you've done or whatever, and I certainly will look into it. But like George, I've never heard that that account before.
And Sinatra doesn't look like the Kennedys at all. You know, where most of the Kennedys have that similar look to themselves. They've got that certain shape of their mouth and stuff.
Yeah.
Sinatra looks like somebody else, right?
I think so, yes.
Well, we're out of time, my friend. Mark, keep in touch with us. Let us know when your new work is done, okay?
I certainly will. Bless you. Thanks for having me on. You and Tom and Lisa are great people, and I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Mark Shaw, as we're talking about the life of Frank Sinatra. Up next, Yvonne Smith joins us as we talk about alien abductions.